supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Fatherhood, I gotta tell you, it's the scariest gift I've ever been given. Like most fathers, I was absolutely clueless about what I was doing or what it meant. I knew all I had to do was love and protect my little girls. But, of course, over the years, my job has changed and their needs have changed, and it continues to evolve today. But that's the story of a more traditional father of the 70s and 80s. What about single fathers or adolescent fathers or older fathers, stay-at-home dads? What does fatherhood mean to them, and what does having a father mean to their children? And on today's show, we want to know, what does it mean to you as a father, or what does it mean to you to have a father?
My dad always said to me, work hard and everything else will work out.
My father said that if the next person to you can do it, you can do it.
My father used to say, do stuff little by little every day, and then over time, you'll have a big success.
Well, my dad would always say to make sure that you save money and don't spend it all, so that was good advice.
Well, my father, when we asked him where something was, he always says, you put your hand on it and it's underneath. He liked to eat pie for breakfast.
That's true. He did eat pie for breakfast.
Well, my father gave me many advice, of course. That's right, I'm here. And look like that, this is my father. You know, my father helped me make it the education, make it preparate for life.
Well, I have kids and I tell them things. You know, I just tell them that, you know, I appreciate them and I'm happy to have them and the things that they do for me. And they really didn't have to buy me a gift. It kind of transcended, it developed from my father to the kids.
Thanks to Emily Haas for a thoughtful montage of voices. Well, I'm joined today by three fathers, experts in different fields, but they're going to help us gain different perspectives on this very broad topic. Solomon Jones is a blogger and best-selling author. He's based here in Philadelphia, and he joins us here in this studio. Solomon, welcome.
Thank you.
My dear friend Chaz Howard is here in the studio also. He's a chaplain at the University of Pennsylvania. Chaz, hi. Welcome back.
Good to see you, brother.
And we have Brad Sachs on the phone. He's a psychologist, author, and director of the Father Center, and he joins us from Maryland. Brad, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And we'd love to hear from you, of course, your stories about your father, good news and the bad news. And as fathers, we want to hear from you also. Our number is 888-477-9499. Solomon, in your book, you go into a great deal of detail about pre- and post-fatherhood. I want to tell you, before my wife got pregnant, we were kind of partners in this. And as soon as she had a baby, my IQ dropped 30 points. somehow, she knew what she was doing, and I had no idea what to do. And I became a bobblehead doll. You know, I just nodded, you know, okay, okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was like that for the next 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about you, about that transition from pre to post.
I think that, you know, for me, I learned a lot because I've experienced fatherhood in two different ways. My oldest daughter is 20. And she's before my marriage. And so it was fathering without being married and without living under the same roof and trying to do all of the things that I wanted to do as a father and running into some barriers and learning some hard lessons. You know, fortunately, we have a great relationship now, but it was a learning period,
well,
I think.
you know, you're talking to a therapist, and when you say running into some barriers and hard lessons, I need to know more.
Oh, should I get on the couch now, or?
Well, you can sit up. I still charge by the hour. What happened?
Well, it was just difficult. I think that the one lesson I learned was that I never wanted to experience fatherhood without being married and without first having that relationship solid and right and loving and caring. And I think the second lesson I learned is that it really is about the relationship and about your presence. We spend a lot of time talking about money, and I spent and gave a lot of money. but I think that both I and my daughter would have rather had the relationship early on. And so, you know, through the various headbutting that went on, you know, we eventually got a better relationship and a closer relationship because I fought for that. But by that time, you know, she was, a preteen. Mm. And so it was difficult. It was difficult emotionally, and it was difficult financially.
So what did you bring in to what knowledge, wisdom, fears did you bring in to being a dad here?
Yeah, I think that, you know, what I knew was that my children needed to know that I was there, and they needed to know that I loved them. And so even before they were born, you know, I started to write about and to think about, you know, how that love would look and what that love would mean for them.
Hmm. Well, I've got a treat for you, Solomon, and you, Chaz. Brad, you wrote a book of poems about early fatherhood called Blind Date. Would you read us one of those poems? And I love the one called First Date. Tell us about it.
Sure, I'd be happy to. First Date, this comes from a collection of poems that I began writing when we were expecting our first child, and some of the pieces also took place after fatherhood occurred. But this was as we were getting close to making this transition into parenthood. So the poem is called First Date. When my child is born, I sure hope I look nice. I think I'll wear that white shirt and jeans. Everyone says they make me look so fit. I've been lifting weights, so I'll be big and strong like a daddy should. Hope my complexion is okay. I plan on smiling a lot, talking gently and sensibly. Maybe I'll learn a new piece on the piano, practice my juggling, or teach the dog an entertaining trick. Think I need a haircut? I'll shave daily so my face is soft, like my father's on the way to work. I wonder if aftershave stings little eyes. The fish tank looks good. I'll have to vacuum once more, though. Is it okay to be shy with your own kid? I'm nervous, like a first date. I hope my kissing has improved.
Mm. Just beautiful. That really captures it for so many of us. So what was that first moment like for you, Brad?
Well, you used, I think when you were describing your transition into fatherhood, something about being scared. And I think there's a tremendous transformation entailed with becoming a father. And there's a certain amount of terror associated with it, too, because there are so many expectations and fears, concerns and dilemmas and expectations that we bring with us. So at times that constellation can really be daunting, certainly for women, but also for men, because they're a little bit less familiar with that kind of intimacy.
Mm. Chaz, do you remember the first moment you saw your daughter, that moment?
Oh, it was holy. It was rich. You know, I cried, and my family, my sister and brothers were waiting outside in the waiting room. And I came out, and I was weeping, and they thought something sad had happened. And I was like, no, it's a girl. It's great. It's a girl. And you know, I've been melted by her and my youngest ever since.
You remember that moment?
Very clearly.
Yeah, I think most of us do. Did that moment have an impact on your life? Did it change your life in a way?
I think so. You know, I think a lot of us who have histories with our own fathers, I think the opportunity to be fathers ourselves is a gift, but it also it brings a lot to the surface. You know, my I had an amazing dad and an amazing mom, and I have some great sweet memories of them. But I lost both my parents early when I was growing up.
How early?
I lost my mom when I was 11, and my dad in high school. I was a teenager. And so when I saw my own girls, I think I thought a lot about my own parents, and I wanted them to be there, and I wish that they, my girls could have their grandparents too. But I saw this as an opportunity to kind of, one, try to do some of the good parenting that my dad and my mom did, and to try to be there, but also to kind of pour into them the same way others in my life have poured into me.
Mm. Solomon, I want to talk about those early days of fatherhood with you. I think you wrote about it in your book. Over the course of your lifetime, up until that point, you learn many lessons about what it means to be a man.
Mm-hmm.
But from the description of your book about fatherhood, your most powerful lesson about what it means to be a man came in the women's hygiene aisle at your local pharmacy. You learned a lot about manhood there in that aisle.
Yes, I did. That's from my collection of short stories about marriage and parenthood called Keeping Up with the Joneses. And it's a true story that happened, I guess, shortly after my wife had our daughter Eve. And she was in need of some feminine products. Could not go herself, and I had to man up. I had to step up. I had to go into that feminine hygiene aisle and grab those products. And it's funny because as a man, you've never done that, and so you go into the aisle and there's stuff with yellow stripes, green stripes, red stripes, ultra long, super long. Ultras, maxis, there's all kinds of stuff that you've never seen before. And so I had to do that for my wife, and it was one of the one of the most embarrassing experiences I'd ever had, because women were walking by like looking at me like, what are you doing? Why are you here? But you know, these are the things that you do as a man, not only as a husband, but as a father. You do whatever you have to do to take care of your family. I don't care how embarrassing it might be for you, because it's your responsibility to take care of these people. And I'm glad to have it.
Yeah, it really shifts everything from, you know, as Buber would say, from I to thou.
Yes.
You know, when you're in the aisle and you're embarrassed and I remember that moment and feeling kind of the same.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's not about me.
No.
You know, mm-hmm. It's not about my embarrassment.
Mm-hmm.
It's about my family.
That's right.
And taking care of the family. Hey, Brad, you founded something called the Father Center out there. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I set the center up actually around the time that my wife and I became parents for the first time. My research in graduate school had actually been on expectant fathers, and I was struck by the ways in which their needs and their unique concerns and dilemmas were marginalized or neglected. So I set it up as a program initially for expectant and new fathers, although over the years it's grown to include different kinds of fathers in different kind of contexts, be they single fathers or fathers of adoptees or fathers of children with disabilities. And it's a place for men to begin to or continue the process of exploring and defining their identity, not just as men, but also as fathers and paternal caregivers.
What do all those groups have in common?
Well, there's a tremendous range of men who come and who I consult with and work with, but I think all of them are bonded together by a strong desire to be caring, loving, engaged caregivers, and to define themselves not just as men who mother, but as fathers. I think that's when a lot of fathers wind up feeling restricted or compressed, as they feel like they just have to be sort of duplicate or replicate mothers, rather than tapping into their unique instincts and intuitions regarding how to raise a child. And when we see and encourage men to summon and call forth that capacity to raise a child as a man, not just as a man who mothers, I think it broadens and expands the definition of who we can be as loving paternal caregivers.
Let me reintroduce all three of you. And then I want to come back, Brad, to what you just said about fathering as a man instead of fathering as a mother substitute. You're listening to that was Brad Sachs, where he's a psychologist, director of the Father Center in Maryland, and we're talking about fatherhood today and what it means to be a father and what it means to be a child of a father. We're also joined by Solomon Jones and Chaz Howard here in the studio. So, and please give us a call. Our number is 888-477-9499. We'll be taking your call shortly. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Tell us about your dad, the good news and the bad news. We'd love to hear from you. So, Brad, let's get back to you. So what does it mean to father like a man instead of like a mother? What are the issues that are different?
Well, there's definitely some similarities between mothers and fathers when it comes to caregiving, but there are some distinct differences, too. And when we as a culture highlight and illuminate those differences and not see them, one is better and one is worse, then I think it really raises the odds that men will be even more motivated to get involved with their children. Men tend to promote more individuation or separation than women do. They're more likely to promote autonomy than mothers are. And the balance between the two genders ideally and optimally creates a self-sufficient young adult, ultimately, who has positive self-regard and a good sense of him or herself. But sometimes, and particularly in our culture, it seems, fathers are just seen more as a supplement than as a complement to mothers. And I think fathers are absolutely essential ingredients, and they provide really crucial nutrients to child development and growth. And when we appreciate that, as I said, I think we maximize the potential for dads to be involved, to be motivated, and to initiate the kind of caregiving that is best for children.
I think both moms and dads have to appreciate and honor that, yes?
Yeah, and many times if the mother feels as if parenthood is her sole area of expertise, then the father's efforts to engage with the children start to feel like an intrusion or a violation, and then it sets off conflict between the mother and father, whether they're married or not. And one of the things I work very hard to do in the Father Center is to amplify men's engagement with children, but also help women to understand how their children are going to benefit when their husbands or their male partners are engaged with these children. And a lot of that work is even with adolescent fathers, but adolescent fathers, too, are certainly capable of and motivated to become strong, engaged caregivers. We sometimes assume that because they're both adolescent and they're male, they have little investment in child rearing. But that, in my experience, that's far from the case.
Huh. That's certainly nice to hear. I also want to talk about father figures. Chaz, you know, you talked earlier about losing a father when you were young. Did you have father figures after that? You were raised by your sister after that, weren't you, your older sister?
Yeah, my sister took me in. She was 23 at the time. Wow. But I have a brother who really poured into me, and eventually my sister got married, and so he became another father figure, and uncles and cousins. But especially at school, I had teachers and coaches and mentors who really fathered me in a sense. And, you know, that cliche of it takes a village to raise a child, I was kind of a handful in some way. I was a big child, so it took a big village to kind of raise me.
You were a handful?
Absolutely. I still am, I think my wife would say.
Oh, my God. Dear sweet Chaz Howard, Chaplin. We'll just leave that at that. Solomon, what about you? Father figures?
Well, you know, my grandfather was a father figure. Of course, my father was always in my life, even after my parents got divorced when I was about 14, I think. But I learned a lot of lessons, I think, by watching my grandfather, who worked hard, who was kind, who was gentle, but who was a man. And
What do you mean?
I mean that he was, there was nothing soft about him, despite his kindness and his gentleness. And, you know, I learned from him that you could be kind and, mm-hmm. and gentle and still be a man. And that was a very important lesson for me.
Hmm. Let's go to the phones. We've got Jake on the line. Hi, Jake.
Hey, how you doing, Dr. Dan?
Okay. What can we do for you?
I just wanted to call and say I really enjoyed the program, and I wanted to just, you're speaking to my point already about father figures, but I just wanted to kind of ask what role a stepfather would play and how some of those dynamics might have been present in the panelist's work or in your own experience, and also how that has an impact when the child's father is still in the picture as well.
I have a feeling you're talking about you.
Yes, sir. I'm very fortunate to be in a little young boy's life. He's about 4 and a half, and learned some great lessons from my own father, and his father's still in the picture and very much involved. So
how's your relationship with him?
It's great. I spend quite a bit of time with him, and I watch him a couple days a week, and it's really great. It really is.
How's your relationship with the boy's dad?
It's tenuous, I would say. Yeah, at times.
Yeah, well, let me hand this over to Brad, who's the real expert in this area.
Well, it's certainly not an unusual situation. I mean, first of all, just as I was saying, fathers have unique gifts to offer their children. Stepfathers do also, because a stepfather not only has that matrix and constellation of strengths and attributes that every man has, but a stepfather will have a certain objectivity and a certain clarity precisely because he hasn't been directly involved with the child from day one. And that can be very, very helpful to the mother and perhaps to the father, too, if the father's open to that. But that sort of rivalry and territoriality just is not unusual. Whenever there's two people of the same gender who are involved in the same thing, there's going to be some competition and some rivalry. And it wouldn't be uncommon for the father to feel threatened or perhaps intruded upon by the stepfather, and vice versa. But I think the fact that, Jake, you are so involved with and committed to being a good and caring stepfather, hopefully the father will see this as yet another expansion of the range of competent, caring men in the children's lives, and that the two of you ultimately will be able to collaborate in some sort of meaningful way.
Jake, I also want to add a cautionary note here. The good news is that you're a stepdad and not a dad. So it's important that you don't take too much control over rules and discipline and all that stuff. I mean, in general, the rule of thumb is to defer to the mother and you know, treat him with more of an open hand. Somebody said, you know, in the early stages, a good step-parent is more like an aunt or an uncle in the house. So defer to mom. Okay, thanks so much for your call. And we're going to have to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about fatherhood. We're going to talk about love and what that's all about and how that manifests itself. We're talking with Solomon Jones, a best-selling author, award-winning journalist who blogs for Newsworks. He's also been featured on NPR's Morning Edition, CNN, and on and on. One of his many books includes Daddy's Home, a memoir of fatherhood and laughter. Chaz Howard, like I said, is a chaplain at the University of Pennsylvania. Brad Sachs is director of the Father Center. He's a psychologist. He's written numerous articles, and his most recent book is Family-Centered Treatment with Struggling Young Adults. And our number, 888-477-9499. We'd love to hear your story. Again, 888-477-9499. 9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
One in three families is affected by problems caused by drugs or alcohol. The Family Training Program is a service for those concerned about their child, aged 12 to 25, that may be using drugs or drinking. If eligible, you will be invited to sessions with a family specialist to help make positive changes in your life and in the relationship with your child. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More at 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-I-WORRY-2, or online at iamconcerned.org.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. Since 1918, the Philadelphia Foundation has strengthened children and families. The Foundation supports nonprofit organizations that enhance parenting, mentor youth, create safe environments, advance individual education, and advocate for children and families. The Foundation can help you make a difference for such southeastern Pennsylvania nonprofits today and forever while you receive tax deductions. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or fellowfound.org.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about fatherhood, what it means to all of us who are fathers. I'm with Brad Sachs, psychologist, Chaz Howard, and Solomon Jones. And Solomon, I want to talk to you about discipline. How do you discipline your kids, and how were you disciplined?
I think that for me, it is a process of steps. So, you know, I've learned that my children really want my approval. And so if they disappoint me, I will let them know that. And that usually will produce some tears and some remorse. And then, you know, it will proceed to taking away something that they like. They have these iPods that they're attached to, and so I'll take them.
That's like an amputation.
It's like, you know, it's like attached to their little fingers. Yeah. So I'll take that. Corporal punishment is a very, very rare occurrence, but you know, it is a last and a last step for me, one that I hate, and yeah. That's not something that I do very often, but it is something that's on the table. When I was disciplined, you know, the other thing is punishment. So you might have to go to your room. You might have to stay there for a while. You might have to stay there for, you know, you might have to not watch TV or something like that. You know, basically that's how I was disciplined when I grew up.
How about you, Chaz? How do you discipline?
I think I learned a lot from my wife on this one, yeah, especially around that word discipline, which I think comes from that Latin root, discipule, or student. And so to me, I think discipline really shouldn't be about enforcement you know, sort of keeping people in line, but it's really teaching. And so I think that's what my wife and I try to do is, you know, you did something wrong, you're in timeout. But after, it's not just about sitting out for 2 minutes. It's let's talk about what happened there and what we can do better. Mm-hmm. I learned a lesson from an old mentor named Will Gibson. He was my predecessor at Penn, actually. And he has two little girls, too. And one of the things that he told me was I was asking him about, you know, what do you do with discipline? And he says that he never wanted to ever put his hands on his girls to discipline them, particularly because he didn't want them to think it was okay for a man to put their hands on them. I think if I had a little boy, I'm not sure, but I have two beautiful, sweet little girls who all it takes is a look. You know, there's that daddy look of you're out of line, you come out of pocket right now. And I think that they catch it. And that's usually enough to send the message and then to disciple them and to teach them about what was going on after that.
Hey, Brad, I'm curious about, what the literature says about that. And you were talking about the difference between mothers and fathers here. And I wonder if a husband and wife have to be on the same page.
Yeah, if there's two parents in the picture, that kind of alignment or congruence between the parents is absolutely essential. But both Chaz and Solomon are focusing on absolutely crucial aspects of child rearing, which is the family has to be led by the parents. The parents have to be the ones who lead the family forward. And too many parents these days whom I work with seem like they want to be liked by their children or popular with their children or their children's friends rather than take the risk of disappointing and making their children unhappy. And that's part of what parents need to do, because when children get too much power and too much lenience, they get very, very anxious. And when kids get anxious, that's when they start to do goofy or maladaptive or knuckleheaded things. So when parents take the risk of making their children unhappy and setting limits for their children to bump up against, and particularly if the mother and father can agree that that's necessary and a tactic or strategy that they're going to use, it really reassures children and calms them down because they don't feel like they're running a show.
Solomon, you know, after my accident 33 years ago, somebody told me during a really bad time in my life, she put her hand on my shoulder and she said, like it or not, she said, you're a teacher now. And everything you do, you're teaching about disability and the disabled. We teach our children about life. We teach them about what it means to be a grown-up, what it means to be a man. But how do you think we impart these lessons? How do you do it?
Oh, God. It is so much about, I mean, my children listen to what I say. They read some of what I write. I'm sure later on when they read some more of it, they'll be horrified that it's about them. but I think more than anything, children learn through what you do. So I can say all day long, don't lie, don't lie, don't lie. But, you know, if somebody calls my house and I don't want to talk to them and I say, you know, say I'm not home, they see what I've done. And so for me, it really is about trying to model for them what I would like them to do and to be. Now, I make mistakes. I am not perfect. But I try to address that with them as well when I recognize when I'm wrong, to apologize to them when I need to, because I think it's important for them to know that you can apologize, but also to use my mistakes as a teachable moment and say to them, you know, I should have handled that differently, and here's why. So it really is about what I do. And I'm very cognizant of that as I watch my little boy kind of imitate the things that I do. I know that's how he's learning from me. I know that's how he's learning manhood.
Chaz?
I think Solomon hit it right on the head about modeling it. You know, I think that the two best compliments I've gotten from my little girl, she's six, Annalise, was when she told me I was good at playing Barbie, which was something I never heard in my life before. And then this weekend when she said, Daddy, you're nice. And we were driving, and someone was lost and, you know, flagged us down and asked for directions somewhere. And we were in a rush. And I asked her if she had GPS, and she didn't. So I put a little address in my phone and gave her directions. And it wasn't a big deal. And Annalise looked up and says, Daddy, that was a nice thing to do. You're nice to doing that. I also love what Solomon said, though, about being vulnerable and admitting that when we aren't doing the great thing, too. We all have bad days. And it's hard, and it's humbling to apologize to my kids for, Daddy used a harsh voice there. I'm really sorry about that. But I think that's an important model, too.
I think it takes a great deal of strength to be comfortable with our weakness.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. We've got Jimmy on the line. Hi, Jimmy.
Hi, this is Jimmy. This is a great conversation. I just had a kind of different question. I was married when I had my three kids. And now I'm separated, and even though my wife stayed home, like I pretty much took care of the kids, because when I was at work, I would come home and make them dinner and take care of them, and then she would go out at night, and then she was gone on the weekend. So I pretty much, if I wasn't working, I was taking care of them. And now that we're separated, I only see them like every other weekend, and, you know, Wednesdays. like, how do I keep that good bond going? You know, how do I deal with that?
Well, I've got a bunch of ideas, but I'll bet Brad Sachs has better ones than mine.
First of all, just so I know, how old are the children now?
3, 5, and 7.
Well, first of all, you've laid down a tremendously strong foundation by being as involved as you have been. And second of all, although your children are still young, it is important to remind yourself that they already have internalized and incorporated the presence of their father. And as kids get older and older, of course, they don't need as much to be directly involved with an individual because they have an image, a connection, a bond with that individual in their mind or in their heart. So it's clearly heartbreaking for you to have been marginalized to the extent that you are, not to have this engagement with your children. Your job, obviously, is to tap into the tremendously strong connection that you've already built with them and to connect with them as strongly and intimately as you can when you are with them. And, you know, without demeaning their mother and without, you know, degrading her in any way, you can certainly make it clear that if it were up to you, there would be more time. But this is the arrangement that, for whatever reasons, has been agreed to. And you're going to cherish and capitalize on and take advantage of every moment you have with them.
I would also add one other thing, and this is going to be difficult, Jimmy. I don't know about your relationship with your spouse or your, I guess, soon-to-be ex, but the best thing you can do for your kids is to do whatever you can to make that relationship as good as you can, as respectful as you can. And I think that would be an act of love for your kids. So that's the input the two of us have for you. I sure hope it was helpful, and I wish you the best of luck. We're going to take a short break now, and I want to come back and talk more about love, and I want to see if we can boil down some of the essential ingredients about what our kids really need from us. We're talking with Brad Sachs. He's director of the Father Center, psychologist Chaz Howard, chaplain at University of Pennsylvania, Solomon Jones, best-selling author who's written Daddy's Home, a memoir of fatherhood and laughter. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has been providing services to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Founded locally by pioneering schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization now helps individuals across our nation to live healthier, happier, and more productive lives. Over the next 6 weeks, Wawa stores throughout southeastern Pennsylvania and New Jersey will help support Devereaux's work. More details at local Wawa stores.
R&B music sensation Chrisette Michele is back with a fourth album, a little more upbeat than the earlier ones. Michele says changing her diet gave her a different perspective.
I found out that there was this great connection between food and the soul. I didn't know if that made sense. I didn't care because it was true for me.
We hear about her new album and outlook next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about fatherhood with Chaz Howard, Solomon Jones, and Brad Sachs. Solomon, the stereotype of the African-American father is pretty troublesome. It's, I mean, we all know what it is. Doesn't have to be repeated. Do you feel that you have an extra responsibility? Are you a role model also for the larger community in the same way I said I kind of felt that extra burden for the disabled community?
I think that I have a responsibility to be a role model for my children. And in doing so and in writing about it for years, what has ended up happening is that I've kind of become a voice for fatherhood. Not only in the Black community, but in the larger community. People write to me and say, you know, thank you for writing that. I learned a lesson from that today. You know, old white guys stop me on the street and say, you know, I really love your work, because the work is universal. It is about fatherhood and it is about parenthood. But more than that, it is about letting that young man know mm-hmm. that it's cool to be like married and be a dad. It's in his hip, you know, to take care of your children and to love them. And, you know, the dirty little secret is that I see lots of young men taking care of children, you know, walking down the street with their children. And that gives me a lot of hope. And so, you know, I feel like I am a voice for fathers across the board. And to the extent that, you know, I can help to break that stereotype, great. But I'll do it while loving and taking care of my children.
Hmm. Well done. You want to weigh in on that, Chad?
See, it's a powerful question. I mean, yeah, and I think I'm certainly aware of it when I'm, you know, on the sideline of my little girl's soccer games and I'm one of two black dads there. And I definitely, that burden of the gaze, I think, is of G-A-Z-E, gaze, is challenging, I think, to, it's a bad motivation. I think it's a poor motivation. I think Solomon hit it, that the motivation is we just want to be a good dad to my kids here. On the other hand, I think it's an important model for young cats who are coming up, who are getting ready to become fathers. But I think there's a bigger stereotype, too, though, about dads in general not being present. I think oftentimes we feel like our job is to be a provider, is we keep the lights on, mom or the other spouse sort of takes care of cooking, raising, decisions, discipline, everything else. And so when I'm at these little soccer games and I see any dad there and a dad is the coach and the ref, I think that's breaking the stereotype too, regardless of someone's ethnicity.
Yeah, and you know, dads being out and being the provider, I mean, that was the truth in my generation. Matter of fact, at the end of the show, I've got a little essay, a little letter I'm writing to my father, who's deceased for about 10 years. Mm. But let's go to the phones. We've got Mike on the line. Hey, Mike.
Dr. Dan, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Hey, Dr. Dan, I just want to tell you a couple things. My dad had a couple sayings, and they just stick with me, you know, over the years. He had one that said, a slow drop of rain will be a hole in concrete. Mm-hmm. And as I grew older, I learned that to mean that you had to be consistent. And so, you know, there's situations that come up, you know, when I was raising up my kids, and then like the author said before me, in my neighborhood, I got known to be a good father, there all the time for my children, and I loved them, and it was with discipline. Now, my son is almost 30, my daughter's in her mid-20s, and they are good people, and what I saw that my father taught us what to do was how to figure out things. My wife has a tendency to want to solve the problem for them. Hmm. But my kids come to me and they say, Dad, what do you think I should do? I said, well, what are the options? And then they look at the problem and then they'll come up with the options and then I support them. But the thing is that to show them love, and my father didn't, he was out of the, you know, John Wayne era. Mm-hmm. He didn't show you love. But when I was 36, him and I had a chance to really talk, and I told him, I said, you never told me that you love me. He said, you remember that orange bike you wanted off of Shelton Avenue that time? I said, yeah, when I was in the ninth grade. He said, you got that, didn't you? I said, yeah. Hmm. He said, remember all those train sets that you and your brother got? I said, yeah. He said, so what do you think that meant? I said, so you did love us. He said, son, I didn't tell you that I loved you. He said, I showed you that I loved you. And that's what I do with my kids. I tell them that I love them, but most of all, I showed them that I love them. And they've grown up to be really good people. My son, like I said, is almost 30, no children. He said, Dad, I'm not going to have any children until I get married because I want to be a good father like you. I know that they love me, and they know that I love them. And when we were going on vacation, we would always take their friends because, like he said before, I had to take other kids along because I knew they didn't have a father. But and my son saw that, so he's always with some young people trying to encourage them on. And that was some of the things that we got from growing up in a loving house. And he always said to me, he said, Dad, when my friends sit around and talk about not having a man around, he said, Dad, that's not my story. He said, I can't say anything. He said, sometimes they almost get mad because they'll say to him, but you had your father. He said, yeah, my father loved me. And that just makes me feel so good. And that's what I want to throw out there. It's just being a father is so much fun going to those soccer games. Hey, my son was on the track team.
Hey, Mike, let me take a wild guess here. I'm thinking maybe you love this job of being a father. Oh. There's a lot of us here that do. I'm so glad you called in, and I'm so glad you shared that story about you and your dad. Thank you. Solomon, you write a story in your book about how you struggle to give your kids healthy foods, and and then there's the grandmother who gives Eve unhealthy food.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you resolve it?
Well, I mean, we like that unhealthy food, and I still eat that unhealthy food, and my mom is listening, and I love her dearly, and I love her fried chicken. So, you know, I think
What's your mother's name?
Her name is Carolyn.
Carolyn, I just want you to know, I got your back here because I'm a grandfather. So we're going to let him talk for a little bit, and then I'm going to tell him the truth.
But, you know, I mean, I think that in our household, actually, we struggle, period, to eat healthy food. Because
easy.
I love my fat and my salt and my sugar and all of those things. And we have a big closet full of snacks, I'm ashamed to say, including Snickers and all kinds of other stuff. But, you know, we express love, and this is a cultural thing. I think that, you know, my mother expresses love through cooking and through serving and through just having the family together, and we're happy to accept that love. And so, you know, what I've learned as a father is to emulate that, not necessarily the cooking, but the serving. Mm-hmm. To be a leader who is also a servant in my household, and I thank my mother for that lesson.
You know, I read a study years ago about family meals.
Yeah.
Families that have 3 to 4 meals together a week, their children speak at younger ages, their vocabulary is better. Mm-hmm. They're some 40% less likely to use drugs or mm-hmm. alcohol. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. Just simple family dinners. So I've got a last question, and then I want to share that letter that I talked about earlier. Brad, I've been struggling with this, just in case my daughters are listening to the show. I want to know about grandfathers on Father's Day. Do we get like a bonus gift? Do we get a grand Father's Day gift, or do we just still get those sappy Hallmark cards? What's the deal on this?
I certainly think there should be an extra slice of generosity extended to grandfatherhood, because not only have we survived fatherhood, but we've taken a step across the threshold into a new phase and a very gratifying phase of life.
All right. So, Debbie, Allie, are you listening? We've got this from an expert, and you still have some time to get that extra gift. Gentlemen, I want to thank all three of you for joining us, and my guests have been Solomon Jones, the Reverend Chaz Howard, Dr. Brad Sachs. Thank you. And like I said, I want to share something with you. It's a letter I just wrote to my dad on Father's Day. Hey, Dad. It's been a little over 10 years since you've been gone, and I still miss you. Thinking about you a lot, preparing this show, and how you shaped my life. Everyone who ever met you commented that you were the nicest man they've ever met. Several years ago, I was invited to Taiwan, and a master calligrapher spoke with me for about 30 minutes and then wrote something on this magnificent rice paper and handed it to me. When I asked my translator what it said, she told me it said kindness. That's what he saw in me. That's what I learned from you. I also got my sense of humor from you. No, you couldn't tell a joke to save your life, but you always laughed at mine. And even when I was little, I could always make you laugh. And I love that, because I love you and always wanted to bring you happiness. I remember my mother always nagging us to kiss each other goodbye. For years she said that, and we never did. It was too awkward. And then you guys were visiting my wife Sandy and me and the girls. And then it happened. We hugged each other. It was awkward at first, but it seems like for the remaining 30 years or so, that's all we did was hug and kiss. Dad, you taught me volumes about love. I felt your love for me every time I saw you. But as I grew, I came to realize your love manifested in many different ways. For 35 years, you worked 12 hours a day, had a job you really didn't like, just so we could live in a comfortable middle-class community and send your two children to college. That was the greatest example of loving devotion I've ever seen. Thank you, Dad. And then there was that wintry day at the shore in January, as your life was coming to an end. You and I sat shoulder to shoulder, looking out of your big picture window at the ocean, not saying much. It was a windy day, and the wind had blown the sand completely smooth, as though everything that was there yesterday was now gone. I put my arm around you and held you close to me, and you took my left hand and kissed me on my left thumb, right where I have the most sensation. The next day was a Monday, and I came to work to do my show. You died that day while I was on the air, and as soon as I was told, I looked down on my left thumb and could feel your kiss. May you rest in peace, my kind father. A love letter for my dad. Next week on Voices in the Family, we'll look at the realities of work-life balance. Well, comment on today's show. We're at whyy.org/voices, and you can download the show there also. Follow us on Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. And me, I'm at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Our summer intern is Anna DeStefano. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. And we say a sad goodbye to Emily Goodman, who's been helping us out for the last month. Take care, Emily. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends. Enjoy.